You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, Chris Kimball joins us to share a new way of thinking about cooking and a new recipe for stew that skips searing the meat, just in time for fall.
First, President Obama recently hosted a leaders summit on refugees to encourage countries around the world to commit more resources and resettlement spaces for refugees.
Stateside, the president is moving to increase the number of refugee resettlements upward from the pledged 85,000 in 2016. The United Nations Refugee Agency reports that more than 65 million people were displaced in 2015, and that number is up from the year before.
The refugee crisis is a worldwide issue, but in the United States, concerns about admitting potential terrorists to the country has made the issue a political lightning rod.
Earlier this year, a group of Republican governors asked the president to halt the resettlement of Syrian refugees.
Priscilla Alvarez is with us now. She's an assistant editor at The Atlantic, where she recently wrote about the history of America's policy approach to refugees. Priscilla, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, to start off, how does the United States compare with the rest of the world right now when it comes to resettlement of refugees?
So you just mentioned this. The United States in fiscal year 2016 pledged to admit 85,000 refugees. When you compare that to countries around the world, and let's take Germany as an example, who it reportedly has more than a million asylum seekers that have entered the country last year, it pales in comparison. So the United States really, in light of all the refugees and the refugee crisis, takes in a handful compared to some of these other countries.
And what do you put that down to? Why is the United States seemingly more cautious about admitting refugees?
Well, a lot of this, at this moment, it's a lot of heated rhetoric. And also, Congress is sort of controls the funding for the resettlement program. So that is where Obama, for example, is, you know, trying and has announced that he's going to up that number in 2017 to 110,000. And at the same time, urging other countries to also take in more refugees. This refugee crisis, according to the United Nations, is the worst refugee crisis since World War II. So it does require a concerted effort by countries to admit refugees from around the world.
And the president recently hosted this leader summit on refugees, a sideline meeting apparently at the UN, asking other leaders, other countries to step up and do more for refugees, admit more refugees, and commit more resources. What was the outcome of that?
Sure. So it was, well, for one, it was official that the Obama administration's goal in fiscal year 2017 will be 110,000 refugees. So that was officially announced before we had known that Secretary of State John Kerry had briefed members of Congress, but it became official then. And then also, yes, he, you know, urged other countries to take in more refugees, but as I mentioned, many of them have already done so. And just to add another example, Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan have taken in the largest share of Syrian refugees. I know that there's been a lot of attention on Syria lately.
Now, in your piece for The Atlantic, you take a look back at American refugee policy and resettlement efforts in the past. And first of all, before we get too deeply into it, how does today's crisis compare with some of these other historical refugee waves? I know you mentioned Vietnam and World War II.
Yes, and those numbers were far larger. So in 1975, the United States actually created or passed, shortly after, the Refugee Act of 1980. And like you said, it was from the wave of Vietnamese refugees following the Vietnam War. Now, these numbers were far larger. And actually, even going further back, it was after the United States admitted 250,000 Europeans displaced by World War II that we got our first refugee legislation. So yes, these numbers were far larger, but these conflicts also dictated what kind of wave we were going to see and how many refugees needed resettlement. So a lot of that was dependent on that. A turning point was 2001 with the passage of the USA Patriot Act. And I cite Bill Frelich, the director of Human Rights Watch, Watch's refugee program, in the way that the US Patriot Act was, or the language at least, would affect refugees in the way that it framed how somebody might have been related to a terrorist organization. So then you also have a problem with, well, who can come and who will be identified as a refugee and eligible to come to the United States as one. So that, I would say, was a turning point for the United States and perhaps why we saw far less numbers than we would have seen dating back to 1975.
Priscilla Alvarez is with us right now. She's assistant editor at The Atlantic, where she recently wrote about the history of America's policy approach to refugees. And Priscilla, you say that if you look back, there were periods in American history, in some of these earlier periods we referenced, where America was more welcoming than we are today. What happened?
Well, again, I would cite 2001, and I think recently, if we're looking at now, there has a lot of the backlash, particularly with Syrian refugees. I mean, just last year, we had more than half the governors in the United States ask for the program to be halted. I think a lot of that has a lot to do with it. I mean, another report that I recently saw was the Obama administration is considering perhaps an adopt-a-refugee program. Now, this is a report, and it's not quite clear if this is something that would follow through, but it is a way to get past the funding. I mean, you have to have the funding to resettle refugees in the first place. It is a hard task, and it's a lengthy one at that. So between that, and I know a lot of churches are also helping in the process, it's a very hefty effort for the administration.
And you also mentioned the Refugee Act of 1980, which may be sort of an outgrowth of the refugees from the Vietnam era. What did that do to change the way we decide who gets to come to this country?
Well, that law established the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and they outline how refugees are admitted and resettled in the United States. And that process is a difficult one. We work with the United Nations Refugee Agency in that process. But I wouldn't say the process has changed so much since then. It more so solidified it at that point. But I think perhaps the most notable thing that came out of the Refugee Act of 1980 was that Office of Refugee Resettlement, which really helps in a number of ways. And again, just going back to the churches as well, there are organizations, interfaith and conservative churches, conservative organizations, evangelical organizations that also help in resettling refugees across the United States. So I think just to take it one step further, something that the administration has also done regarding refugee policy is opening the door to Central American migrants. That's not to say that they didn't look at Central American migrants before to be admitted as refugees, but what they have done now is that they are working with the UN Refugee Agency to look at people in El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala to see who is eligible there and who can identify to come to the U.S. And that was a big step for the administration in light of what has occurred in the United States with immigration reform to look at Central American migrants and look at their conditions and take them as perhaps people that could be eligible for refugee status in the United States.
Priscilla, what's next as the country now continues to weigh its policy and its political posture toward refugees?
Well, I think it depends a lot on the next administration. We don't know that. People that I have talked to, organizations that I've talked to, a lot of it is contingent on that and what the next administration decides to do. At this point, we're looking at the 110,000 number that the Obama administration has put forward. But a lot of that will sort of depend on who our next president is in deciding how the United States continues to look at refugees and how they decide to decipher how many will be eligible and from where.
Priscilla, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Priscilla Alvarez. She's an assistant editor at The Atlantic, where she recently wrote a piece looking at historical policy toward refugees in America. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the very public split between Paul Ryan and Donald Trump runs right through Wisconsin. We'll find out how it may play out in our state and beyond.
First, the weather is colder. We're in the midst of stew season, and stews are great for cooks who are pressed for time. Just throw a bunch of ingredients in a pot and let it simmer.
unless you're cooking a meat stew, then a lot of recipes call for you to sear the meat, which can take up a lot of time. Chris Kimball of Milk Street Kitchen stopped making stews altogether for a while because of that searing step. He set out to find a non-searing recipe and discovered most cultures don't even sear their meat in a stew.
He wrote about this in the first issue of Christopher Kimball's Milk Street magazine, which hits newsstands next week. And he joins us now for a sneak peek. He's the founder of Christopher Kimball's Milk Street. Chris, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I love the welcome you have in your new magazine. You tell stories. You start by telling a story about your time in Vietnam and how you sort of learned the cooking language there, which led you to realize there kind of was no such thing as ethnic cooking. Could you tell us that story about your time there?
Yeah, I was there, and I was going to get a cooking lesson. I was picked up by a friend of a friend on a motorbike, not a car. And I used to drive a taxi in New York, so I thought I was used to anything. But driving through Saigon in a motorbike is a near life-ending experience. But we got to their apartment, and I took a lesson for a couple hours. We made dumplings and everything else. But it occurred to me that this idea of ethnic cooking is such a 19th-century notion, really, because everyone just cooks dinner, right? I mean, so if you're in Saigon, you don't go, let's have Vietnamese food. Or if you're Mexico, you don't say, let's have Mexican food. It's just supper. It's just dinner. It's just lunch. And you can learn from all these people. You can learn things which you can bring back home, not how to cook their food authentically, but how to think about cooking food and how to use different ingredients and how to, maybe use less meat, more of a flavoring. So I learned how to use a vegetable cleaver, for example. That's something I brought home with me, that knowledge. So it's really everybody sitting down at this really big table. And as I say in that editorial, all food is everyone's food.
Yeah, I think Muddy Waters, the guitarist, had a line something like, if you like it, steal it, meaning take inspiration from everything you see out there. Is that what this way of thinking opens us up to do? We see something in Mexican cooking or Vietnamese cooking or whatever, we don't have to say, I'm going to try to do Mexican or Vietnamese cooking. Right. I can steal these ideas for whatever I want to make.
I'm not sure I would use that particular verb. But
well, maybe not steal. Be inspired by.
Be inspired by, thank you. Well, think about the music world and the fashion world. I mean, there's reggae, from Jamaica, but, there's reggae in South Africa, too. The fashion world has borrowed, begged, stolen, inspired by every culture. The pattern of colors in Central Africa, for example, or Japanese costumes, it's a mashup of everything. And the one place this has not happened, it's happened in restaurants, hasn't happened with home cooks. And the thing that's really amazing is that you can cook more simply, but cook better. Because Northern European food, which is the basis for a lot of classic American food, is about technique. It's about meat and heat, and it's about using technique to coax flavor out of fairly bland ingredients. But if you look around the world, they have herbs and spices and fermented sauces and chilies, all these things, where you don't have to go to great lengths to coax flavor because you're starting with big flavor.
Do you think is your magazine and that whole approach in a way a response to the food world where there's fusion cuisine, but then there's also sort of what we put in a different category, which is ethnic cuisine? Are you trying to get rid of all these labels?
Yeah, I remember being in a Mexican restaurant in New York in the 60s with my parents, and there was the mariachi band and people dressed up and all the colorful tiles and everything, and that was sort of like, in a way, the worst of ethnic cooking, you know what I mean? And now I sort of feel I've traveled a fair amount, and I just meet people who cook. I don't, it's not ethnic. And you just cook with people, and everyone's trying to put food on the table, so sure. Yeah, I think it's a little like sort of neocolonialism. It's like it's our food and their food. Well, it's not. It's just food. It's everybody's food. And so you can learn so much, if you want, from how other people prepare food, not to steal recipes or to do it authentically. But you learn something. Every time I cook with someone from a different part of the world, I learn something, and I want to bring that back. And sometimes what I learn is, you can cook a chicken in a pot of water, as they do in China. And actually, it turns out great, and it's really easy to do. So why not do it?
Talking to Christopher Kimball. He's founder of Christopher Kimball's Milk Street. He's sharing a philosophy of cooking, and let's get practical now. We teased that stew concept, Christopher, and you're right that it's very common in stew. We want to sear that meat a little more, as you say, to coax the flavor out. And you found that most cultures don't do it that way. What kind of things did you learn that could jazz up our stew?
Well, I mean, here's the revelation for me. I've been doing this for 35, 40 years. If you have 2 or 3 pounds of stew meat, why would you need to saute the meat? Well, the reason is that you get more umami flavor, right? That you create more meat flavor. You already have 3 pounds of meat. You know, the last thing you need is more meat flavor. So if you look around the world, everyone uses water, not stock. I mean, why do you need stock? If you cook meat in water, you get stock. So start with water. You don't have to saute the meat. And what you end up doing is saving time and effort. And two, you create a stew that has lots of other flavors that are independent and bright and fresh. You have cilantro in it. You have cumin in it. You have chickpeas in it. You have carrots in it. You know, you have lots of bright, distinct flavors. And that's the takeaway for me, is that Northern European food is very melting pot. Like, everything comes down to one flavor, one texture, like a beef stew. The rest of the world has bright handfuls of herbs at the end, or they use ginger, or they use scallions, or they use some chilies or whatever. They have independent flavors that all contrast with each other, and it's easier to do because you don't have to go through all these steps to as I said, to develop flavor, because you're starting with flavor.
Right, and you also mentioned cooking chicken in water, and this is in your new magazine.
Sure.
You've got a recipe for poaching, basically just poaching chicken. Is it that simple?
Yeah, it's an old Cantonese, and they do all over China. You take 4.5 quarts of water, a couple cups, if you want, of sherry or mirin, if you like, a little, throw some scallions and ginger in. You cook a whole chicken. You don't have to cut it up for 25 minutes at a sub simmer. Leave the top off, and then let it sit for half an hour. You will get perfectly cooked breast meat and dark meat. And you can take that out, and you can take it off the bone, or just, in China, they just cut it into pieces, but you take it off the bone, and then make a very simple sauce with soy sauce and sesame oil and a little bit of the water, now stock, you've made. And that water has turned into stock, and you can use that to make rice. So it's foolproof. It's about 3 minutes of work, you know. And it works every time, and it's very simple. Here in America, for years, I've always been focusing on the skin, right? How to get perfectly crispy skin.
Yeah.
Well, most people in the world don't really care about that. And so this infuses flavor into the meat. And you don't have to worry about the white meat being overcooked. It's always perfect.
Interesting. And you talk also about being inspired to use spices and herbs more, and think of some herbs that I might think of, you know, cilantro or something like that, as I'm going to sprinkle a little cilantro on the top, actually treating it more like a green in the mix.
You know, the thing I hate most in French recipes, although I love French cooking, is a sprig of thyme. I mean, really? You know, what is a sprig of thyme? Thank you very much. You know, you could use 1/2 cup of dill, or 2 cups of cilantro, or 2 cups of basil, or, you know, or parsley, or anything else you want. You can use large amounts, and other cultures do. And go back to the stew. At the end, like in the Ukraine, when they're finished with a meat stew, they just cook some tough meat and water for a few hours, and they throw 2 handfuls, literally handfuls, of fresh herbs in at the end. And so you're right, herbs are greens. Think of them that way, and you can make all sorts of salads with cups and cups and cups of herbs. With grains, with beans, with other things, and it's just delicious. I mean, herbs are not, you know, forget the tablespoon. Those days are over.
And what about garlic and incorporating garlic into recipes, maybe something like that stew?
Yeah, well, I have a totally different feeling about this. You know, in Rome, you never get garlic breath, and the reason is they use whole cloves, or maybe they smash the cloves, but they don't mince or press it. And that releases all sorts of enzymes and something called allicin, which has a very strong flavor. So in the stew, we take a whole head of garlic, remove some of the loose papery outside, but keep it intact, cut off the top quarter, throw it in the stew, cook it for 1.5 hours, whatever, pull it out, and then squeeze the garlic head that inside the cloves are very soft, squeeze them into the super stew. It gives you a really rich, deep flavor, but it doesn't have garlic, and it's not overly garlicky because you haven't cut the clove apart. So you get rid of that problem. So that's how most people use garlic, the whole cloves or even whole head, and you get a wonderful flavor, but it's not overpowering.
You know, getting back to the idea of ethnic food, I mean, are we losing something if we don't explore more where these things come from? You're not looking to totally disassociate the ethnic cooking ideas from their origins.
No, no. I think it's really important to start somewhere in the world. I'm going to Thailand in December with Andy Ricker, who does the Pok Pok restaurants out of the Northwest. I had to go to his home. And so, yeah, it's important to tell the story where it comes from. But I think what's really important is you really can't do authentic, you know, Oaxacan Mexican food at home, right? I mean, the ingredients are different, different kinds of chilies, everything. The water is different. The people are different. The way you serve the food is different. So the idea of really being able to replicate authentically a food from other place probably isn't going to happen. The culture is different. What you can do is explain, like, you know, what's harissa? Where does it come from? How is it made? And then how are we going to do it here? It's really important to talk about where it comes from. But then you need to adapt it to what we're going to do here, because no matter what we do, it's not going to be the same.
Chris, a lot of the recipes in this magazine, they do share new techniques. For instance, you've got, I think it's a Japanese take on a pie crust, which does not shrink, which is the bane of my quiches and my pies. I mean, are you still learning new stuff with this?
You know, about 5 years ago, I started reaching out to lots of other, you know, cookbooks and ways of cooking. And I realized that I got really excited about getting back in the kitchen. So that particular technique is a milk bread technique, and we adapted it to pie pastry. And I've made 1,000 pies in my time. I've made a lot of pies. The crust is so much better. So I've learned so much in the last few years by opening up to how other people cook without the notion that I'm cooking their food, but with the notion that they can teach me something about how to cook here. And I've learned so much, and that's just an example. It's a Chinese name for a Japanese method that actually works with pie pastry instead of bread.
Mm. Well, Chris, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks so much.
That was Chris Kimball, founder of Christopher Kimball's Milk Street.
Coming up, Paul Ryan has stepped away from Donald Trump while others in his party are staying close. We'll find out what the prospects are for GOP unity 4 weeks out from Election Day. We ask you to weigh in. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Latino USA. Tonight's story is about two similar but different public schools and the challenges Latino kids face when they get up in the morning and put on their backpacks. That's coming up tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, after tapes were released of Donald Trump speaking graphically about women and describing sexual assault, the debate with Hillary Clinton Sunday night was tense, but the exchanges between Donald Trump and members of his own party since the release of the tapes have been making the headlines since then.
Trump was disinvited by Speaker Paul Ryan to what was initially intended to be a GOP unity rally on Saturday in Elkhorn, Wisconsin. It was a decision that was not popular with all of the attendees. Ryan said that he would not defend or campaign for Trump between now and Election Day on a conference call with House Republicans. On Monday, he advised them, quote, to do what's best for you in your district, end quote. That statement drew a tweet from Trump this morning that said, again, quoting, our very weak and ineffective leader, Paul Ryan, had a bad conference call where his members went wild at his disloyalty, end quote.
Other Republicans are lining up behind one or the other, leaving insiders and outsiders alike wondering about the future of the GOP. Mike Wagner joins us now to talk about the conflict and how it could play out, and here at home in Wisconsin as well. He's an associate professor of journalism and mass communications at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Mike, since that debate, it almost seems, maybe at least today, like Donald Trump's biggest enemy is his own party. He tweeted today, disloyal R's, Republicans, are far more difficult than crooked Hillary. This is from his tweet. They come at you from all sides. They don't know how to win. I will teach them. That's the quote from today. So how would you describe what's taking place between Donald Trump and the Republican Party right now?
Well, it's really remarkable on the one hand, because we see, you know, the tweets he's sending out. We read the stories about what Speaker Ryan had to say in the conference call. We heard the sound and saw the video from the rally that was in Wisconsin this weekend. And all of that, I think, is remarkable. On the other hand, you know, I don't quite know that I agree with Trump's analysis there. You know, Hillary Clinton is still his biggest problem, and she is his competitor in the race. And so he does need to make sure that he turns out Republican voters if he wants to win, and he's not doing that at the same clip that Hillary Clinton is. But she's his biggest problem, and if he wants to have an opportunity to win, he needs to get the focus off of the internal problems in the Republican Party and start to focus on his opponent.
And right now, as is a symptom of what we're describing, going after maybe more members of his own party that he doesn't feel are supportive enough, House Speaker Paul Ryan has been, of course, deeply involved in this. Ryan withdrew from campaigning or defending Trump, but he didn't withdraw that endorsement. And at that rally yesterday, he was booed by some Trump supporters. Do you think this is emblematic of the tug of war going on in the party at large in some way?
I think it is an example of some of the internal issues the Republican Party is having to deal with right now. And, you know, people in Paul Ryan's shoes, he's thinking of, you know, Republican candidate or Republican elected officials who have endorsed Donald Trump but aren't wild about Donald Trump are in a position where they certainly don't want to defend many of the things that he has said. And they also know that many of their constituents strongly prefer Donald Trump to be the next president, like his ideas, prefer some of his policy proposals that are the ones that are getting more attention, like dealing with immigration and dealing with refugee crises in Syria and other places. And so they're stuck between a base that really likes Donald Trump and their own dissatisfaction with the way Trump is running his campaign and the kind of candidate he is. And it's very fascinating to watch all of this play out in real time in a way that we just don't normally see in a presidential race.
And Mike, do you think it is possible for people who are on that fence or trying to walk that line to pull it off? I mean, you've got Paul Ryan, so he is trying to walk the line between mitigating hard feelings maybe with Trump supporters, but also wanting to soothe conservatives from the party who do want to see Donald Trump face some tough consequences for those remarks about women that he made. I mean, is it working for Paul Ryan, or is he maybe just ticking off both sides?
Well, I think that's a very difficult needle to thread, because as we saw, you know, at the rally, and as you see on social media, and as you see from the Republican nominee for president, there's lots of criticism from conservatives to Speaker Ryan. And yet there are also plenty of conservatives who are happy that Ryan is drawing some kind of line about Trump in the sand. And there are conservatives who are dissatisfied that Ryan hasn't gone further in a disavowal of Trump or a withdrawal of an endorsement. And so I don't know that it's possible to satisfy all of these different constituencies. It just speaks to the complicated nature of elections. So Paul Ryan certainly appears to be done offering full-throated defenses of Donald Trump, but if Trump falls so far behind in the polls, that could really affect whether Republicans have a chance to maintain the Senate and could also really eat into their very large majority in the House. And, you know, some poll watchers think that it's possible that the House could get into play. That is not something the Speaker of the House wants to hear.
Mike Wagner is with us right now, an associate professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison, talking about the split in the Republican Party right now with Donald Trump at the center of that. And I wonder how likely you think it is that we could see an election day where some supporters of Donald Trump who are upset that he's not maybe getting the support from party members, party leaders that he's looking for, that they could, you know, sort of revenge vote on election day and just vote for Trump and leave the congressional races dangling.
It's possible, but if someone is a Donald Trump supporter, would they rather have Paul Ryan be Speaker of the House or Nancy Pelosi? If a voter in Ryan's district is voting, would they rather have Paul Ryan be a congressman from that district or Ryan's Democratic opponent? And so, you know, it's difficult to imagine people voting for the Democratic Party candidate if they're a Donald Trump supporter. It's possible they could leave it blank and do what's called rolling off that particular vote and not vote for Republicans whom Trump supporters believe are not giving a full-throated enough support to the Republican Party nominee. But there are other options are generally worse for them in terms of the policies that they prefer and how they would like Congress to act. And a President Trump won't be able to do much without a Republican majority in Congress.
And I want to ask you one more question about this Wisconsin angle. Another Wisconsin player, Reince Priebus, chair of the Republican National Committee, has taken the opposite tactic of Paul Ryan and has said, you know, we are in full coordination with the Trump campaign. We have a great relationship with them. That's a quote, and it's an interesting one because Priebus and Ryan, Scott Walker, were the architects of taking Wisconsin conservative values to Washington, and yet Ryan and Priebus are on different sides right now. Is that sort of Wisconsin alliance dead, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think it just speaks to the different roles that they play in the Republican Party. Reince Priebus' job is to win elections. And he knows that if people do not turn out to vote, even if Donald Trump can't win, if Trump supporters don't turn out to vote for Republicans, they could have a catastrophic election day up and down the ballot at the federal, state, and local levels. He does not want that to happen. Paul Ryan's job is to, you know, win an election for himself, but his real job is to govern. And the elected officials in the Republican Party who've been backing away for Trump are also thinking about how they want to govern once this election is over. And that's a different set of questions that they have to ask themselves as compared to Reince Priebus, whose central question is, how can I get as many Republicans elected as possible?
Mike Wagner from UW-Madison is with us right now, and we're talking about the prospect for Republican Party unity right now in the aftermath of the release of the Trump tapes.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you are a Republican voter, what do you make of the divisions within the leadership? If you're a Trump supporter, how do you feel about Paul Ryan's current position? If you support Paul Ryan and his decision to not defend, he says, not campaign with Donald Trump, what do you do about voting for president? Regardless of what party you vote for, do you see a way for the Republican Party to reunite around common values? Can they do it in the next 4 weeks? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're continuing our conversation about Republicans, some of them at least lining up behind either Paul Ryan or Donald Trump, and looking at what that divide seems to be here in Wisconsin.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Paul Ryan be going all out to support his party's nominee, or do you agree with his decision to back off a bit? Will you take the candidate's position on Trump into consideration when you go to the polls to vote in your congressional race? And if Donald Trump and Paul Ryan both win, how will they work together? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR.
And we'll take a caller now. We've got Jerry joining us first in Waukesha. Hi, Jerry.
Hello.
What did you want to share?
Well, what I'd like to share is what I just told you. I'm a Trump supporter, have been since before the primary. You know, it's a little disturbing, the comments you made, but it's not incomprehensible or to the point where he shouldn't be running for the ticket. If you look back 40, 50 years, go back to Kennedy, JFK, he was one of the biggest womanizers ever, and it was clearly an apparent and in the media quite a bit during those days, and that's when it was probably most frowned upon.
Jerry, I want to ask you, do you have any strong feelings about Paul Ryan sort of walking back some of his most full-throated support, and also John McCain, people like that, taking some of that in the endorsements back?
No, I think John McCain's mad about what Trump said
campaign
primary, yeah. And I think Paul Ryan, he has to do what he has to do to protect the interests of everyone in the Republican Party. So he's walking on the fine line or the eggshells or whatever you want to call it.
Jerry, thanks a lot for calling. And Mike, hearing from one caller there who says he's sticking by Donald Trump, not completely on board with those comments. He says I can't remember the word, unsettling, but they're not enough to make him feel like Donald Trump should not be president, and he's going to vote for him.
I would imagine that your caller was the kind of voter that someone like Speaker Ryan is hoping for. So someone who supports Donald Trump and wants him to be president, but isn't going after Republicans for walking back their support. I think the caller said, Speaker Ryan has to do what he has to do with his other constituencies in the party. And that's the case Ryan is trying to make. And to the extent that Republicans in the electorate agree with that, he'll have an easier time. If he gets more of the negative reaction of Trump supporters and Mr. Trump himself, that could cause more problems down the road.
Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. And we're going to go next to Michael in Madison. Michael, hi.
Hi. I am a Trump supporter also. I'm sick and tired of hearing all of the news media, radio, television, talk about the slips that Trump has had in the past few weeks. Nobody's talking about Hillary Clinton and all her problems. I also think, the news is the news, and the news is in business for one reason, to sell news. So if it bleeds, it leads. I'm also reminded by the fact that many years ago, somebody said, "He who is without sin among you, let him throw the first stone." And everybody's throwing stones. And everybody's acting like they're lily white.
Michael, thank you for the call. I appreciate that perspective. And, is there something to that? Is Donald Trump and the tape, is it pulling too much focus and the media is chasing this down instead of spending enough time focusing on Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think, the caller is quite right that the video, for example, that was released, a few days before the debate, the Access Hollywood video, has all the elements of a media feeding frenzy. It confirms suspicions that some of the media have had about what Donald Trump is like behind closed doors. There's video. There's audio. It's incredibly graphic and newsworthy, and so it's going to get a lot of attention. That around that same time, a lot of the speeches or sections of speeches that Hillary Clinton gave to people on Wall Street and such a few years ago were released by WikiLeaks, and I imagine that would have been a really big story, but for this Access Hollywood tape. And so it's really knocked, a difficult thing for Hillary Clinton off of the headlines and put a more difficult area for Trump in the headlines. He's tried to counter, though, when he brought people from Bill Clinton's past to the debate on Sunday night, but he hasn't been able to change the headlines. And, it's been a problem for his campaign, and the latest poll numbers suggest the campaign is in perhaps beginning a free fall.
Take another call. Michelle is our next caller from Whitehall. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
What did you want to add?
Well, I just wanted to say that Donald Trump was not my first choice. I don't like some of the things he said, but I'm very angry with the Republican Party for not standing with him. And in so doing, they're just going to hand it over to Hillary, and that just makes me very angry. Makes me not want to vote for them, but my heart says don't vote for them, but my common sense says, yes, I'll have to vote for all the other Republicans that are running.
Michelle, thank you for that call and that perspective, and that sounds a bit like you were getting at, Mike, saying that you think a lot of Republican voters will be pragmatic about it, as you say, kind of Paul Ryan is right now, that it's more important to get Republicans elected.
Right, and I think, she points out she very articulately pointed out a situation that a lot of Republican voters see themselves in. Donald Trump was not the choice of most Republican voters for most of the primary season. He had more votes than everybody else, but he didn't get above 50% for a long time. The party wasn't able to coalesce around someone else, and Trump won the primaries fair and square. And now he's going up against a Democrat who, of course, has very different ideas than most all Republicans in elective office. And so partisans on the Republican side find themselves in this, difficult position. And, it's a little bit like the position that really strong Bernie Sanders supporters find themselves in with whether they can support Hillary Clinton, although the differences are that the Sanders supporters, by and large, are now saying that they will be voting for Clinton, and Trump has not been able to close the Republican ranks in the electorate as effectively as Clinton has so far.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Mike Wagner. He's an associate professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. And he joined us now to talk about the growing divide within the Republican Party and how it could play out, or the party could come back together before Election Day.
Still time for you to share your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. In an ongoing series, WPR News is reporting on a class of Madison police recruits as they go through the training academy. They're entering the field at a time when more and more people are discussing implicit bias and its role in the high-profile killings of African Americans by officers around the country. As Bridget Bowden reports, the recruits recently took a test to determine their implicit or unconscious biases.
Harvard's implicit bias test works kind of like a video game. It measures the speed at which you associate good or bad words with black or white faces. It takes about 10 minutes, and at the end, it tells you your level of unconscious bias. Madison's police recruits are required to take the test. Ruben Gonzalez didn't think he had a preference for one race over the other, but learned from the test that he does.
I kind of was shocked by the response, and I was like, I don't think this is right. And then I took it again, and I got the exact same thing. And so that was kind of hit hard, you know, because I wouldn't think that I had these implicit biases.
The makers of the test define implicit bias as stereotypes that are outside of our awareness or control. Almost everybody has them, and they're deeply ingrained in our culture. Gonzalez says he felt better when he realized that most of his classmates had some level of implicit bias, too.
Discussing it with some of the people that are in class now, just acknowledging this doesn't make you a bad person.
Officer Jared Prado is part of a group within MPD that trains officers on implicit bias. He asked the recruits to stand up and think about their test results.
In a minute, I'm going to have you move within the room based on your result on my end of the room. If your result was a strong preference for one group over another.
On the other end, people whose results said they had no preference, and
in between we'll have moderate and then slight.
The recruits spread all across the room. Ray Gillard grew up in a poor, mostly African-American neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. He's black, and he says he was surprised that some of his classmates did have high levels of implicit bias.
And then you just see how the room became divided when we took the test. It kind of opened your eyes that, well, they are still from a different area, so maybe they have the same biases.
He says he hopes knowing about their bias will help the recruits be fair when they hit the streets as officers.
So everybody's going to have their biases, but it's whether you act on those or not.
Next, Officer Prado shows a historical timeline of law enforcement and African Americans. The recruits learn about plantation police who kept slaves from running away. They're confronted with images from Bloody Sunday in Selma, Alabama. They see videos from recent killings of unarmed black men by police. Gillard says it was hard to watch.
Because I didn't know that police in America first started as plantation police. So that really took me back to the doubt, did I really just join an organization that was originally started to discriminate against people of color? So.
Officer Prado says it's imperative that police learn their history and not gloss over the ugly parts.
Our history is something that we have to own. It's something that we can certainly do better today, but it's hard to do better when we don't contextualize these relationships that are institutional, historical in nature.
For Gillard, confronting this history makes him question his decision to join the force, but it also motivates him to do better.
What made me want to come here? I'm still unsure. Why am I here? But I just want to try to make a difference so that people who's come from the same background in a predominantly poor neighborhood don't experience the same things that I had to go through.
Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.